Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Heidi Holton, and this is 91.7 KEXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Go to KEXE.org to find playlists, podcasts, and more. We are member-supported radio made possible by people like you. Sometimes we need a bright spot in our day. That's what you get when you tune in to KEXE.
And our ancestors show us, in the face of incredible adversity, what it looks like to persevere, what it looks like to keep moving your feet forward. You know, Martin Luther King talked about, if you can't walk, then you should crawl, right? But you must keep going. So my encouragement is, you do have an important role to play, and you must not grow weary in doing good. Rest if you must, but do not quit.
It's Minnesota author Sharon McMahon from a KEXE Conversation. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the bright spots that you hear. You can text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234.
Welcome to Cow Stories, program by people of color, for people of color, and everybody else. I'm Luz Maria Frias. I am happily enjoying life in an unstructured world and doing fun things like executive coaching, DEI work, and serving on boards.
I'm Anthony Galloway, partner at the Dendros Group and pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota.
I'm Holly Lee, owner of the Other Media Group, VP of Programming at Ampers, and Counter Stories producer.
And I'm Don Eubanks, member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians and associate at Dendros Group.
We have a very special guest today to help us really delve into Native American history in celebration of Native American Heritage Month. And we've had her on before, and we're welcoming you back. So please share with us your background and what you do, Adrian.
Anin, Makagawi Kwandajna Kaz, Mississauga Ganayanda, Shimana Singh and Dunjaba. My name is Adrian Benjamin, English, and I am from also the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe along with Don. And I am a full-time artist, activist, educator. I currently am working as a contractor, as a reconciliation advisor for Minnetonka Moccasins. On the side of that, I do my own cultural and, I guess, public art. And prior to all of those fun things, I spent a majority of my career building and bettering youth programs for my tribe, Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. And happy to be back. Glad to be asked.
Welcome back. Absolutely.
Sure.
So you're a busy person. Just with that introduction, you are a busy person. So we're going to delve into some of that as the conversation goes on. The theme of today is to really understand a really important aspect of celebrations, but also honoring traditions along the lines of jingle dress. And the significance of what a jingle dress is, the dance that comes along with it, and all the different elements that are attached to it. So let's begin with the history. It's my understanding that it dates back to the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe in terms of its origin, but help us understand how that came about and how that has evolved.
I always like to preface this, and I want to do it here. I do it everywhere when I do talk about this story and talk about the jingle dress, that this is Mille Lacs' story of the jingle dress that was told to us. One of our most famous, I'll say even, they say he's one of the most famous Anishinaabe that ever was at this time is Larry Smallwood. And he was a really famous powwow MC throughout the country. He told this story and talked about it and really put it in the forefront and kept it alive from elders that told him the same story. So I always like to talk about that first. And I also like to acknowledge that there are other origin stories that come from other tribes about this dress. And a lot of times I've seen people, you know, say, well, it's really came from here or it really came from there. And from my knowledge of historians and their records, like it really can't be traced to the original beginning. And so what I like to talk about is that I think it's quite lovely that we can think of this dress in the way that it came to our people through a dream, and that it possibly came at the same time to a few different places when it was needed to come to us. And so with that, I will enter into talking about that origin story of the dress. So the story that Mikagabwe told was started with an old man in our community here in Mille Lacs. He had a daughter that was very ill, was very sick. And he kept having this dream over and over about these four women wearing these dresses, and the way that they talked about it was with metal cones on them. And it made this beautiful sound like rain, or like it's nothing he had really heard before or seen. And this dream had happened over time. And finally he thought, okay, maybe I should tell my wife about this dream. And in this dream, he dreamt of these four women wearing four different colors. They were red, yellow, green, and blue. And they were dancing in this specific way. And I know we're on radio, so I'm trying to be as descriptive as possible. So the way that it's described is that they danced forward, maybe almost in a shuffling motion, in an S straight with very straight steps, gracefully. They didn't dance backwards. They didn't turn around. And when they danced, those jingles made that noise that the man remembered in his dream. So when he did tell his wife about this dream, she got together with some other women in the community, and they decided that if he had dreamt this that many times, that perhaps that these dresses should be made. And they didn't really have an answer other than that at the time as to why. They just decided to do it. And so some women got together and they created those four dresses in those four colors. And at that time, that the man's wife showed those women how to dance. Here in Mille Lacs, it's part of our culture. It's called the ceremonial drum, and it happens in the fall and in the spring. It's a place where we were gifted these drums by the Bwana people, which is our word for Dakota, Lakota people. And they've been in our communities history writes about it, I guess, in terms. They decided to bring these four dresses out at one of our ceremonial drums here in Mille Lacs. And at that time, they brought along their daughter who was sick. And it said that she was laying down. She wasn't very well at all. So she couldn't, you know, it was even hard for her to be at this event. And this man got up and talked about the dresses and talked about the dream that he had, why he and his wife thought that they should be made. And they had those women come in and show the people and dance in those dresses that he dreamt about at that time. And as that night went on, those women danced in the way that he had seen in his dream. And the story is said that as those women danced, that little girl started to perk up, and she started to even participate and got behind those ladies and started dancing with them. And that is our community story of how the jingle dress came to be known, at least as the healing dress, and where it came from was from that dream. From that point, the dress was gifted to other reservations in different directions in different areas. And we see what we see now across the country with powwows that have adapted and adopted the dress into their own circles and regalia. So when we think about the jingle dress here, One thing that Mille Lacs says is we're the home of the jingle dress, but we're also the home of the sidestep because of the type of song that goes along with this dress and the way that it was dreamt about happens here in our big drum ceremonies. So a little fun fact there.
This is Counter Stories. You're listening to a special rerun of our episode, Meaning of Art, The Jingle Dress. I'm Haley with co-hosts Anthony Galloway, Luz Maria Frias, and the late Donald Eubanks, with special guest Adrian Benjamin. This show is supported by AMPERS and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com.
I think it can be, in different, it's become so popular now in powwow circles and just across the country that sometimes people just wear it in contest powwow. And I don't know that there's too much teaching behind it, but to those that know the teachings and you know, especially here in Mille Lacs, we understand what that means to wear that dress and, you know, the origin behind it and the power behind it too. One thing that I can share that I've personally seen growing up, is there was a time at Mille Lacs Powwow, and Don, perhaps you were there or no, remember this, but, there was an elder who actually had a heart attack at the annual powwow. And at that time, I mean, when the ambulance was there and that specific individual was being loaded up into the ambulance, even they called out all the jingle dress dancers to come and dance for that man. And I remember he survived that heart attack. And so for me, I was always like it was just, you know, it was like a moment because I'd always heard the story. And I guess when you're in the presence of it and you understand it, like it has just a different power and feeling. And I mean, even just, recently I was giving a presentation at Central Lakes College in Brainerd. And, I mean, most of the folks that gave comment in the audience were talking about the way that it made them feel. And I think that really speaks to the depth of it, whether you know the story or not. I think that people just, it just brings a different feeling for people. But that's one time I do remember. And I remember just being blown away, and sat, that was a long time ago, and that elder has passed away now, but I remember he did live quite a few, many years after that happened. And I always remember that and talk about that story when I'm asked about the jingle dress too.
This is Counter Stories. You're listening to a special rerun of our episode, Meaning of Art, The Jingle Dress. I'm Haley with co-hosts Anthony Galloway, Luz Maria Frias, and the late Donald Eubanks, with special guest Adrian Benjamin. This show is supported by AMPERS and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com. In the Hmong culture, we have something very similar to the jingle dress. It's our coin clothing. And it's so funny, I was walking through Hmong Village with an Indigenous friend just the other week, and we were talking about it, and she looked at the Hmong and she's like, so this is your jingle dress? And it's it's very similar, you know. And so I don't know the reason, the meaning behind the coins. There's different theories out there for the coins. One is that if you look at the very, very old clothing, they're French coins because the French were colonizing Laos at the time. And so they would pay Hmong farmers to farm and harvest stuff for them. And they would pay them these coins that were of no use to the Hmong farmers. So they started using them as decorations on their dress. That's one of the theories. But a lot of it used bandao, the cross stitching. And so growing up, we as the girls had to do that. Every summer was spent at my grandma's house doing bandao, right? And so is that something that you grew up with? Is that something that happens within your community, within ours when we were younger, having to make our own dresses?
I would say yes. And I think that maybe, I don't want to say that the value of making has like lessened, but I think that the understanding of the actual what goes into the making has maybe went away a little bit more, because nowadays, like, you can buy pre-rolled cones. Mm-hmm. I buy pre-rolled cones. Some people, like, I feel like it's this artist thing where they're like, I roll my own, you know, they have this like,
for Hmong people, like, there's now machine made bandao. Like, it just goes through the machine and it comes out perfect. There's no wrong stitch, like when we do it ourselves, right? And people will pay more for the handmade stuff because there are the imperfections.
The idea of value, right? And these coins and these things that just probably could have took them somewhere and had some kind of, you know, got something for the tin, but instead they're putting 300 or 400 onto a dress. Or, you know, if there's a kid, 200. People ask me about that too. Well, how many go on a dress? And I would just say, until it looks good, right? Like that, because there's a lot of stories out there too that were like, oh, well, we have one for each day of the year. And then I've heard, like, you know, other people go, well, we didn't even follow the Gregorian calendar. So where did that come from, you know, and stuff. So it gets interesting when you talk about it. But to me, that was the teachings that I was given, is like, you know, you're also mindful if like a dress is someone's like first one, like you don't want to have it be too heavy for them, or they're not used to that too. Cause I mean, it is an athletic activity to say the least, to dance, but it is something that I definitely grew up with. I think I made my first dress when I was like 13, and I had some friends that were a little more apt to it than me. And I remember I just took apart one of my grandpa's old shirts to try to figure out how to even put something together like that. And it's like, I tell this story because it's funny too. So I was the Mille Lacs princess, and maybe this is a context that might need a Dawn explanation further too. Not a forever title. It's like a once in a year, kind of an ambassador role. But I was the Mille Lacs princess when I was like 12, 13. And they had you take like professional photos, right? And I'm wearing this dress, and so it never goes away. I hate it. And I'm like, oh God, that's the first one. It was like, you know, like 90s all the way. Like, it had a satin collar and whatever. Yeah. But that was modeled after one of my grandpa's old, like, button up shirts that I found in his closet. And it's forever in the old D1 center. A picture of me wearing that dress is in there as Mille Lacs princess. I'm always, Good, humble reminder of the beginnings of my tangle dress making there.
Did you save it? Do you still have that dress today?
I don't. I have moved so many times in my life that I don't. I wish I did. Maybe it exists somewhere out there. If I spot it someday at a powwow or at a museum or something, I'll know it for sure. Like, because it's white and blue satin. And yeah, I would never forget it ever.
You're listening to Counter Stories. I'm Luz Maria Frias with co-host Hilly Lee, Anthony Galloway, and Don Eubanks, and special guest Adrian Benjamin. This show is supported by AMPERS and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com. You know, I think about the sentimental value of that all, right? And the memories that come with it, and certainly the sentimental value that it was your grandmother's tins, you know, and the care that she took to put it away for you, but also the love that she must have been thinking about as she was putting this together, and knowing that you would then at some point in your life wear them with pride, you know, knowing that it came from your grandmother. I think about that as you tell this story. Now, we talk about quite a bit in throughout our segments about appropriation. So the question that I am asking you next goes to that. Can anyone wear a jingle dress? And when I say anyone, I'm thinking folks outside of the Native community. It's not lost on me that we just celebrated Halloween, and we take a lot of intentional steps here to make sure that folks don't begin to appropriate things that they shouldn't. So can you speak to that?
Well, first I'm going to ask Don to talk on that because he's the elder here. I always, when it comes to the rules, I'll give that one first to Don, but I'm happy to talk about what I was taught to.
I think that you should just go ahead and jump in because, you know, that one becomes interesting because I don't remember any particular stories about those kind of things. What I remember, Adrian, what I remember being taught is that we gifted things. And so it wouldn't surprise me if one of these was gifted to someone outside of our community. Now, appropriation in terms of how we mean that now, I think, however, is totally different. And because I personally have never seen anyone, although I think I've heard, like, there's that Running Man, Burning Man, Running Man, whatever, or and that's because I'm an elder, right? So where there might be people who imitate that kind of stuff, then I think it's inappropriate because they don't know the significance of what they're doing, right? But I think that if someone was gifted it, that they usually then are told the story behind it. And I think that then it has much more meaning.
My answer when someone asks if anyone can wear a jingle dress is no. I think that and that's not even just from the Mille Lacs perspective, but I think I've listened to stories from the other communities that, you know, claim the home of it and their own origin stories about it. You know, it's a process for some folks that, you know, back in a long time ago, it was like regalia was something that was also dreamt about. And I've gotten asked that question before. They're like, you know, you make all of these things, you make these dresses and, you know, and in old days, this. And I also look at it from a creator's eyes. And I don't mean like I'm Kichimanadu over here by any means. Just an inside joke with Don, sorry. But I look at it like as a maker, or let's go there. And like, I think of these things, like if someone talks to me about a dress that they want to have, or if they're already a seasoned dancer and they have, you know, if it's their tribe has a, you know, a rite of passage to wear those dresses, if it's dreaming, if it's that they did A, B, C, or D, or they were gifted one from their grandparents and said, hey, that you should wear this, then I'm only doing my part as someone who has those visionary skills as an artist to create and bring that to life. Like, that's how I look at it in terms, because people are like, well, if people aren't dreaming of this, they should make it themselves. But to me, that it's an art form of reclamation in itself as well, because not everybody was as lucky as I was to grow up with a Mikagaboiban, right? Or to understand the teachings, or to come from this place that I come from to learn the deeper meaning of the dress, to have teachers that took me under their wing to teach me sewing and make me better at it. So when I think about it too, and someone comes to me and they're like moved by it, or I always wanted to be a jingle dress dancer, like, who am I to take that opportunity away from them? Like, to me, I should give them that opportunity as a maker, right? And to go back to the appropriation question, I think that specifically why it's a hard no when it comes to a Mille Lacs perspective, maybe on the dress, is that because it is such a sacred thing that came from that dream and that, it's just like other regalia, I guess. I don't know that I see too many other people trying to do that. I think it's more of a question than actually something that is a want or has happened outside of Burning Man. But like, I have had someone ask me one time and I didn't know how to take it because it just felt weird. And I like to tell it because I think it gives a perspective on why it would feel that way. But I had someone ask, could you just make me a dress? I would never go out in public anywhere or go try to, you know, join in a powwow, but I might just dance at my home with it on. This is a non-native person that asked me that. And I was like, you know, I just, why?
Yeah, like, I don't trust that.
thank you. Like, I don't know. Yeah, it just was not good. It wasn't the vibe. You know? So it's like, for what? Like, what's the purpose there?
You spark a really important question. Like, you create fashions, you know, with the beaded fedoras and the shirts and things like that. that are stuff that somebody would wear in public.
And right? can wear.
And can wear, right? This from the moment you talked about it, sounded like it was something for a function, for ceremony, for you know, a particular thing. And that notion of needing to have a piece of somebody, like those are some I think those are some of the deeper conversations that we aren't having because we stay at the surface from what we can see, the food we can eat, the cultural things I can point to at the top of the iceberg. But down at the bottom, I think you're hitting on a mental model that is really important, right? This need for historically to have a tangible piece of something to put on your wall. I feel the same way when I walk into folks' households who ain't got no connection to Africa whatsoever. and you see all of these masks in statues and stuff like that. And the question becomes, why? What is the need to have a piece of a thing? And I think, you know, we have to be uncomfortable enough to ask, is that the piece of us that we have soaked up and learned in this society that says that anything that is non-white normative, I need to treat as an object that I can have a piece of? I run into the same thing when in drumming. The djembe, what the djembe represents. And I'll see people, you know, I walk into classrooms and see people with a djembe there and they have like a cup on it or they set a clipboard on it. And I'm like, yo, what the hell are you doing? Like disrespect, like there's that thing. And I think it's worth unpacking because that is a marker of something that can go much deeper. Where am I in a relationship with some, you open the door, so I'm gonna go there. Am I in a relationship mm-hmm. with somebody because I truly love them? Or is this an extension of that piece of me having a piece of that culture? And I'm dating interracially because of the novelty rather than the meaning or, you know, the person. Like there are these things that get real tricky in that regard. So I appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, like I think that it goes super deep because it opens questions for me too on just like I said, there's a huge why there. And like what you said about your drum, this for me, I failed to find the words often like in English that in like common culture, right, that can even equate to the sacred understanding of that dress. And same for your drum, right? What makes it just, you know, there's been so, and I think this another itchy point is like, there's been so many things taken and colonized and like, you know, we want this and that and the other thing. And I think it's okay for cultures to say like, this is ours. This is something we do. And that it's okay part. That part. It's not for you.
We are so grateful for you and to you, Adrian, for your time, for sharing your knowledge, sharing your gifts with us today. You have your own website, you know, you are an artist. But in closing, I wanted to offer you an opportunity to say any closing remarks that you might have before we end the segment.
You know, I did spend a lot of time talking about the jingle dress and why that is sacred and something that maybe other people shouldn't wear or isn't something to be appropriated. You know, do better as a buyer. I think the best thing is to do homework and to speak to artists, to buy directly from artists that are, you know, specifically from tribes. And you can always ask questions, you know, and be an educated consumer to know those things, you know, because there are beautiful things out there, the beadwork, the birch bark.
Well, thank you for those closing remarks. Really valuable and insightful and for all of us to really take in and understand that. I'm Luz Maria Frias, living life, enjoying it to its fullest, and doing some work on the side with DEI executive coaching and some board work.
I'm Anthony Galloway, partner at the Dendros Group and pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota.
I'm Halili, owner of the Other Media Group, VP of Programming at Ampers and Counter Stories producer.
And I'm Don Eubanks, member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians and associate at Dendros Group.
Micah Gabawikwe, Adrian Benjamin, Mille Lacs band member, artist, reconciliation advisor, activist.
Thank you so much. Migrit. This has been Counter Stories, a co-production of the Counter Stories crew and Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com.
Thanks so much for listening to KAXE KBXE. My name is Heather Johnson, and I'm the membership coordinator here. If you're enjoying our music, news, phonology updates, and conversations, consider supporting the station by becoming a KAXE KBXE member today. Do you have questions about membership? We offer many options for making your contribution. I would love to chat with you. Give me a call at 218-326-1234.
Native Lights with your host Cole Primo and Leah Lem, produced by Ampers. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in on this Sunday evening.
Our issues are so urgent. Our issues are so complex, and we cannot go through these issues alone, and we need each other to come up with solutions.
Hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Mi gwech for joining us today. Today we're revisiting our chat with Leanne Littlewolf, a Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe citizen and co-executive director for the American Indian Community Housing Organization in Duluth. ACO's community-informed programs aim to create a stronger, healthier, more stable Native community in Duluth. Leanne shares about her path to leading at ACO, how her work and ACO's service are built around community needs and engagement, and what is next for the organization. We spoke with Leanne in February of 2023. Enjoy.
How are you doing, Leah?
I'm great. How are you?
Super great, you know, just chilling.
I'm convincing people left and right of my greatness.
So I know a lot of focus, you know, with urban natives is kind of centered around the cultural corridor in Minneapolis, but there is a Native community in Duluth, Leah.
You betcha.
And there's Native communities everywhere, of course. But our next guest is helping a lot in that community. And so I'm very excited to speak with her about all the work that she's doing in the Duluth area on the shores mm-hmm. of Lake Superior. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited to speak with our guest today. Her name is Leanne Littlewolf. Bonjour, Leanne.
Bonjour, Hanin. I'm Leanne Littlewolf, Indigenous Kaz Jaganashimowin and Sogiyajik Indigo, Mayungan Indu Dame, and Gazaga Squaw Jimikagna Unjiba. And I use she, her pronouns, but my traditional name is Everyday, and I belong with the Wolf Clan, and I come from Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm a tribal citizen. And I am the co-executive director for ACO, which is the American Indian Community Housing Organization.
To the American Indian Community Housing Organization, could you just talk about how it all began? I know in 1993, it was founded. Could you just tell us how it began and how it's evolved since then?
Yeah, I wasn't around when this organization started. And how I understand it is that there was a few Native community members who were at a community meeting up at the Damiano, which is like a social service center. They had been in that meeting and they felt frustrated that there wasn't a lot of emphasis on Native issues. So they left the meeting and they went out in the parking lot and they were talking about the things that they wished for. And then they're like, and we're in a parking lot. Like, this is our meeting spaces in this parking lot. So from that is my understanding is that they decided to start a nonprofit organization, and it was established in 1993, became a 501c3 organization. The first thing that ACO focused on was emergency shelter for people that were fleeing violence. And so they started with Dabanu Event Shelter, which is a 10-bed shelter. They purchased a single family home and renovated it to shelter space. And so that's been up and running since the mid-1990s. And then, you know, shelter stays are usually 30 days. It's not enough time for people to really get on their feet. And a lot of times when someone leaves like an unsafe situation, you know, you're leaving with what you can grab. It's usually not much. So to, you know, just think about rebuilding your life and grabbing like maybe a backpack and just throwing whatever you can and getting out to save your life. Like, you know, that's the situation a lot of survivors are in. So the next thing that ACO did is they purchased an apartment complex and they turned it into transitional housing. So then shelter residents could have access to that transitional housing. And, you know, and that's usually lasts for like a year to 2 years, helps you get on your feet, and then you can move into permanent housing.
So it started as like mainly geared towards housing, correct? And then now there's like all these different programs within it. Could you talk more about the additional programs that have come out of ACO?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is like when you have access to community space, there's so many things that are possible. There's so many things that you can do. And so downtown Duluth, the YWCA had built this building in the around the turn of the century, early 1900s. And it's a historic building. And they decided that they wanted to sell it. And so ACO was in position to buy it and purchased the building in 2007 and worked on renovating it for like 5 years, had to raise like over $8 million to renovate it. And this space, you know, it's huge. There's like a big gym. There's a swimming pool. It's not used anymore, but there's a lot of space in the lower level. We have a community center. We have a rooftop that we actively use, and there's a lot of office space. And then there were single room occupancies, so they were SROs, and they were put in place because the reason the YWCA had built this building was that they had heard, the women in Duluth had heard that there were young women who were coming to Duluth, getting off at the depot, and they were coming here for work. And it was young immigrant women. And then they were going missing. Nobody knew where they were, and they were just gone. So the women got together and they raised money to build this building. And they wanted young women to have a safe place to go. So they would send people down to the train, go and meet the young women, bring them up, and then they can rent an SRO. And they did a lot of like employment support and those kinds of things. So the building itself has a lot of history around like responding to community need. And so when ACO moved into this building in 2012, they renovated the SROs into 29 units of permanent supportive housing. So there's efficiency, 1-bedroom, 2-bedroom, and 3-bedroom apartments on site. So we have 29 households that live on site, and that's like single adults, families with children. You know, we usually have anywhere from 30 to 40 adults and anywhere from 40 to 60 children that live on site. So this is their home. And then community space. So we have what used to be the Trepanier Hall, which was a really beloved community space. It was, people had candidate forums and they had folk dances and they had the Unitarian Universalist Church met there. I mean, it was used for many different purposes. We renamed it the Dr. Robert Paulus Cultural Center. And before the pandemic, we would have over 300 different community events in that space. So this building, the Gamaji Manoba Ma Dizzy Min building, has become like a community hub. And when you have community come in, community brings their ideas, they bring their vision, they bring their energy. And so that's really when you're talking about the different programming, it all has stemmed from our Indigenous community. That's how our arts and cultural programming started. That's how our children's and youth programming. We do a food sovereignty initiative. We have social enterprises. We have we do gardening on site. We have a health equity initiative, which really came as a result of the pandemic.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ambers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Leanne Littlewolf, Leech Lake Mandeville Ojibwe citizen and co-executive director for the American Indian Community Organization in Duluth. Leanne, could you just talk about, you know, being the co-executive director at the organization? Like, how does that work? And I know, how's it like to work with co-executive director Michelle LeBeau?
So I worked at ACO in 2017. I started working here in 2017, and I took on a role as an advocate training specialist, and it was really focused on addressing sexual violence and domestic violence and community violence, and coming up with training to help our whole community respond better to American Indian survivors. And I did that role for a year, and then I became the economic development director. And there was some really direct connections between the year that I spent doing research on violence and trying to figure out first we have extraordinarily high experiences of with violence. And while I was doing that research and thinking about doing the trainings, I had to really connect that to my own life. And so I started thinking about when I was a little kid and how much violence I saw as a little kid. And it was normalized, even though it's the most abnormal. Those are the most abnormal experiences. And I realized that no one throughout my whole life had ever talked with me about that. Nobody helped me make sense out of that. Nobody helped me put that into a context or a perspective. Nobody helped me make meaning of how I could repair myself and also continue in the world in a good way. And so I realized I had been left unattended as a child through that, and as an adolescent and as a young adult. And I thought, how many of our community members have experienced that? I'm kind of wondering, but it all is tied together, because those, in leadership, you have to care about the issues that impact our people, and you have to care about the issues that impact that. And a lot of times they're the unspoken issues. And it's really easy to follow trends and say what everybody else is talking about. It's a little bit harder to really pay attention to where our people, what the issues are. And a lot of times they're invisible for a long time. So I think about the issue of missing murdered Indigenous relatives, right? Which started out as missing murdered Indigenous women. And, we had something really horrific happen in my family to my grandma. And as a child, it had such a deep impact on me, and I never spoke about it. And I think about that incident almost on a daily basis, and have done that my entire life. And I always thought that my family, this was a very abnormal experience that nobody else went through. And there was a lot of stigma with it. So I never talked about it, not even with my other family members. And then when there was legislation proposed for the Missing Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force, we went down, ACO staff, myself and another staff, we went down to the hearings, and we heard Native women testify, and the same similar stories, different stories, but heart-wrenching, heartbreaking stories. And after that hearing, we all went out into the hallway and we sobbed and we held each other. And to me, that was I realized our issues are so urgent. Our issues are so complex, and we cannot go through these issues alone. And we need each other to come up with solutions. So in my leadership here at ACO, I'm excited to work with my community. I'm excited that I'm in a position that I've been working my whole life to figure out how you run a nonprofit organization, and how do you secure resources, and how do you put good ideas into action, and how do you work with others in a good way? Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
I wanted to ask about the mural outside of the building in Duluth, that big, beautiful, powerful mural. Could you just talk about, talk about that mural and just how that came to be?
Sure. I think that Hannah Smith was working with Honor the Earth, and they wanted to do a large public mural in Duluth. And they approached ACO to see if we would partner. And Honor the Earth had a connection with an artist collective called Insurgents. And so it just kind of came together. And we had a space up on our rooftop on a wall. And Insurgents showed up. It was Voltan, Derek, and Leah. And they had, they talked through what should this, it was co-designed, I guess. And it was they came through with these ideas. And then they really wanted to have a message about protecting the water and the importance of our water. And I think that the artists, they listened to the community, and they started to pull together all of these different ideas around you know, Anishinaabe women's role with protecting the water and the issue with resource extraction and how a lot of times that's associated with violence towards women and missing, murdered Indigenous women, and how that we're aware of those connections, but the wider community often isn't. And how can we protect our water if we're not protecting our women? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of complex ideas in that mural. And it's also around visibility, that we are here, and that's the first large scale public art piece created by Indigenous artists, you know, in our city. So that's really important too. You know, we have like statues and we have different things, different art pieces that have been, they look Native, but they're created by non-Native artists. So, you know, there's that issue. I think since the mural has been up, you know, it has brought a lot of attention to those issues, and then also brought a lot of like recognition for Indigenous art. And we have more Indigenous art now in Duluth than ever before. Like if you go to the Gitxo Day Park, there's a collective of artists who worked on the different murals there. And so it's just been really incredible to see Duluth be a place where our art flourishes.
You talked about, you know, the mural and it bringing awareness to certain issues to the wider public. Could you just talk about that maybe a little bit more? And just are there other, you know, ways that maybe this organization is bringing about awareness of issues in order to tackle that?
Yeah, I think that we're a community organization, and like we went to present at this there's a community grant fund, and we went to present, and there was a lot of community people there, and they had never heard of our organization. So we were a little astounded because we've been here for so long, but there was not awareness that we exist. So we either have like ACO, you guys are great and you guys do incredible work and there's a lot of recognition, and then there's like no recognition. So that's like this really strange continuum, right? So we're right downtown. We're very visible. I don't know. It just astounded us. So, but the way that as a community organization that we work on a lot of these issues is like we will have community gatherings. So like ACO put on around like climate change, we had an artist showcase, and that brought in like artists from all over the place who had just this different expressions and different, just beautiful, incredible art. Art, you know, speaks in a different way to us, you know, and it evokes like our emotional response. It engages our thinking in a different way. It challenges us. It does so many different things. So you can walk in front of a visual piece or they got so many different ways that there's art. It engages the community to think deeply about those issues. We've had like a modern dance performance here with Rosie Simmons on DNA and historic trauma. I mean, that was incredible. It was a free event. And a lot of our events are cross-cultural. So there's people from many different like cultural perspectives who come. So you get like this like learning. It's like this mutual learning. I don't know. So we do that. And then we do some advocacy. Like I said, we went down to the legislature to support this task force, and then so excited to see when it finally passed. And then they had that task force and they came out with a report. So we helped share out that report. And then the office was initiated. And we also work, you know, as we're allies with other community groups. So we also wanted to see the office for the African-American women, you know, who have been missing and murdered. And it's not like we want to lift up all of these issues. And then there's still, you know, we have community members who are missing and we need attention on that. But other ways that we lift up issues, I would say like one of the biggest ones in the last several years has been food sovereignty. And, you know, I started here in 2017, and ACO had already started some really great practices. So like I said, we have a permanent supportive housing program that's on site, and the staff early on decided that they weren't going to offer free, you know, like high sugar foods. So when they started a pantry, it has staples in it. There was a food truck that would go around and they could pull food off of it. They made a decision not to take sugar foods. They took fresh foods and they started cooking meals on site. So they had started that. There was garden boxes that were built by staff that had woodworking skills. They just said, well, we'll just make some garden boxes. And they started planting. And then people gifted ACO with traditional plants. So there's sweet grass, there's sage, there's tobacco. And then those are opportunities to teach about those plants and what they mean to us and how they help us. And we have had, you know, historically, we've had a lot of cultural disruptions and some families and some individuals we don't grow up knowing. It's not our fault. So anytime that we can always do, we can always learn. So it's great to have the kids help gather the sage. We talk about the practice of smudging. We talk about plants as our relatives. And then those kind of early practices grew to the, you know, now there's like veggies and herbs and perennials that grow up on the rooftop and then in a back garden. And then the youth, you know, take that and they go to farmers market with it, and they also create products with it. We had a visitor come from Pine Ridge, Nick Hernandez, who came to talk about how there's so many entrepreneurship opportunities through like food systems work. And it was like these young girls who came in, they were talking about the lotions that they were making and the hand salves that they're making. And they just jumped up and started talking about the different plants that they used and what the properties of that plant were and like why they were using it. And, you know, they're gaining like all this traditional plant knowledge, and it's incredible. So I think that's, you know, you see our culture come back in a really powerful way. And then, food sovereignty is our right. It's our right to our foods. It's our right to have knowledge about our foods. It touches so many different issues. You know, it's about our environment and the quality of our environment. You know, we should have clean water to have our rice in. The stuff that's going on with the climate is really concerning with our foods. So it kind of connects to a lot of different issues.
Is there some overlap with the Indigenous First gift shop and foods? Because I remember Cole asked me a couple years ago, where can I get a big old bundle of sage? I was like, Indigenous First gift shop. Is there some overlap then with the gift shop?
Yeah. So the gift shop started as ACO started with an art gallery and started doing art shows with artists. And then that merged into this Indigenous First art gallery gift shop. And the focus was on art. And then we purchased a corner grocery store, and we're going to turn it into an Indigenous food market. And so it takes time to do a development like that. So in preparation, we had like a small bookshelf that had some Indigenous food on it. And that has grown to a corner of the gift shop. And it's incredible the amount of revenue that has been generated, both by the art and the food. And I would say that they really exceeded, the revenue has exceeded like anything that I would have thought of. And 2/3 of it goes back directly to the artists and the entrepreneurs. So there's that. And then we're building relationships with food producers so we can get ready for that market to open. So we started a winter market, and then that turned into a summer market. And again, the focus was on art and food. And those are incredible events. And then every year, ACO would have a baboon market. So in November, there would be a market with vendors. And what it is it's like easy access retail space, you know, so it's like for emerging and established entrepreneurs to come in and to like showcase their work. And they usually sell out. So it's pretty incredible. I would say that with Indigenous First, the shop started with about 20 to 30 different artists that were featured. We have two coordinators, co-coordinators. It's Avery Makes Room for Them and Cayman Goodsky. And I asked Cayman to add, like, can you tell me how many people are featured in the shop? It's 129. So, you know, in 2017, it was about 30. We're in 2022, 129. And once our community saw that they could have access to retail space, community members started to innovate and bring in high quality products. So I would say, like, even people who never thought that they would be like an entrepreneur were like, well, I have this great idea. And like one of my favorite stories is Cayman. Cayman came and said, hey, I want to see like baby clothes that are like Indigenous and like have our art and our ideas. And what do you think of that? I said, well, it'd be great if you sketched up some ideas and like just go from there. And so within a couple hours came back and said, well, I have these three designs, and they were great designs. And so then came and took those and got them vectored by a local artist, and then researched where to get onesies and then where to get them printed. And within 2 weeks had them on the shelf, on the shelves in the store, and they sold. And so, and it was like, resiliency. It was around like, predisposed to learning my language. I mean, they were takes on like the negative stereotypes with us and then turning them into these like positive strengths that were for babies, you know, messages for in hopes for babies. So that's one example, but there's like many examples, and we have so many. Either they've been established, but they just haven't had retail space. And then we have emerging entrepreneurs who are just like, yeah, I could do this. And that's the whole hope with the Niwin Market. A nonprofit can build a community-owned business. And what I hope is that other people in our community will say, well, ACO did that, but I want to do that, and I can do that. And we need to see more Native businesses.
Thank you very much for your time today, Chimi Gwech. If you have any, you know, final thoughts you'd like to say with, you know, the organization, or just any future events that are happening or anything like that, let us know.
Well, then, I want to say to both of you, like, thank you for having this radio show. I listened to the show. You did an interview with Kim and Goodsky, and I would listen to that interview like multiple times. And I would listen to that interview with my grandson. So we listened to your show. Like,
awesome. Yes.
So thank you for doing this. So it's nice to meet both of you.
Leanne Littlewolf, everybody. It's great to see hear about all the great work she's doing in Duluth, and how that organization is, you know, has evolved, and it's evolved with community there. So,
absolutely, I have been looking forward to talking to Leanne. I know I've admired her work from afar, and yeah, it's really great to speak with her.
Yeah, so thank you to Leanne Littlewolf, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Citizen and co-executive director for the American Indian Community Housing Organization in Duluth. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening.
Yigawabamin.
Native Lights, Where Indigenous Voices Shine, is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Michael Goldberg, host of the weekly show Stay Human. Coming up on Sunday, December 15th, we're hosting an afternoon of live storytelling, stories of endings, and stories for the end of the year. Starting at 2 o'clock at Clocko Brewing in Grand Rapids, some of the folks who've been regulars on Stay Human, and some irregulars too, will have a brew and a story for you. And it's an open mic, bring a story to share if the scene and the beer inspires you. With support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, it's Stories for the End of the Year, Sunday, December 15th, starting at 2 p.m. at Clocko Brewing. Hope to see you there.